Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 671. Update on the Meltdown, Part 4, Germany, the Underground Reich, and the Global Financial Crisis. This program is being recorded on April 26th of the year 2009. We're going to plunge right in and resume with what we were talking about on Side 1 of the program, or at the conclusion of Side 1. I have been reading, and am going to continue reading, an article from the European Journal of May 2008. This is an article by Sarah Moore, the author of two books, Peace Without Victory for the Allies, 1918 to 1932, and How Hitler Came to Power. The article is titled Germany, an Emerging Superpower, Comparisons with the 1930s, and what it does is to compare Germany's deflationary economic policies in the present time, or really in the late 1990s and early 2000s, when the European Central Bank and the European Monetary Union and the Euro came into being, with German economic policy executed under Chancellor Brüning in 1930, in which Brüning basically raised taxes and slashed wages, and wound up hoarding cash and continued Germany's status as a huge exporter, but the average German was suffering greatly. And this convinced many that Germany was too poor to pay back her reparations payments. And it is the contention of Sarah Moore that with the European Central Bank having kept rates relatively low, interest rates low in the early part of this decade and in the, during the closing of the last decade and the creation of the euro, this basically caused people to buy American bonds, American T-bills, and when the European Central Bank began to raise interest rates repeatedly in the mid part of this decade, that then caused capital to begin fleeing America for Europe to take advantage of the higher interest rates. And that in turn left people who had gone for the variable mortgages and the subprime subprime-related instruments to collapse, basically, when the variable rate mortgages began to go up and people with subprime ratings could no longer pay those, and the various debt instruments that had been executed, turning that debt into, in effect, assets, they went down. And it is the contention of Sarah Moore here that German deflationary policy in the 1930s and German deflationary policy today may very well be executed for the same reason, namely boosting Germany into the world driver's seat. We're going to overlap a few sentences with what we concluded side one with. Again, Sarah Moore, Germany and Emerging Superpower Comparisons with the 1930s. And Moore writes, foreigners' faith in the euro rests primarily with Germany. Other Euroland countries' economies are not so strong. Indeed, Germany's European neighbors have suddenly discovered that Germany effectively imposed a wage freeze, unquote, on its workers after the adoption of the euro in 1999, clawing back 40% in labor competitiveness against Italy, 30% against Spain, and 20% against France by 2007. Britain's bankers shed few tears over France and Italy when they complained of the ECB interest rate rises making their businesses uncompetitive, or even Spain hit by an ECB-created property bubble. Britain's pound was strong in the spring of 2007. It had moved tightly with the euro for the last 3 years, but as it always paid a little more in interest than the euro, many European countries held their balances in pounds. However, in July of 2007, the Bank of England decided, in view of Britain's rising inflation, that it would raise British interest rates, too, 1 month after the ECB. Unfortunately, the combination of the American subprime crisis, an overleveraged home market, and the final European interest rate rise was too much to bear. The mortgage lender Northern Rock cracked, and Britain herself suddenly seemed fragile, too. In a way, one could say that the present credit crisis is the delayed result of the euro's arrival. Germany was the strongest country in Euroland at its inception, but outsiders worried that she was still nursing a hangover from her reunification party in 1990. She was allowed to breach EU rules that stipulated that annual government deficits must not exceed 3% of GDP, and the ECB also promised to keep European interest rates at 2% to help the German economy. This encouraged the world's spare cash to avoid the euro and to seek higher returns in the U.S. The Asian economies accumulated vast sums from exports and piled them into dollars. So the bankers had the bright idea of lending money to the underprivileged so they, too, could share in the American dream. Instead of living in dirty, dope-addicted neighborhoods, they moved into detached houses with gardens and driveways. The trouble was that the subprime mortgages started with low interest rates, which soon became higher. Money began to ebb away from the U.S., attracted by rising interest rates in Europe. In 2008, the subprime mortgage crisis threatens to be one of the largest losses of American wealth ever seen, wiping out a generation of home wealth building. Despite Germany's impressive export performance in 1930-31, most people believed her protestations of poverty in the Great Depression because of the misery and unemployment of the German people. When the euro was introduced in 1999, the German economy's health was also in question. Yet in 2003, Katinka Barasic of the Center for European Reform wrote an article called Germany, the Sick Man of Europe, which asserted that Germany, with its flourishing high-tech sector, was not as infirm as many made out. Once more, the world's largest exporter, she was also the principal trading partner for most Eastern European countries joining the EU. Katinka Barasch, actually, that's B-A-R-Y-S-S-C-H, Katinka Barasch declared that what distinguished Germany from most of its peers, unquote, was the weakness of domestic demand. Indeed, after the arrival of the euro, German workers suffered years of stagnant or declining wages. Then, the German government, in an admittedly pale comparison with 1930, decided to cut corporation tax and give other advantages to industry and to raise value-added tax, bringing pain to the workers in order to pay for it. Naturally, in January of 2007, the German unions asked for more money to compensate them for the increase in taxes. Yet after wage increases of 4.1% were agreed with Germany's most powerful union, IG Metall, the head of the German Bundesbank, Axel Weber, declared that wage inflation was getting out of control, there was a growth in the money supply, and the ECB needed to raise interest rates to curb it. On May 18th of 2007, France's bank chief, Christian Doyer, flatly contradicted Weber's comments on inflation. Yet, Euroland interest rates were still raised to 4% with the expectation of more, causing money to pour out of the dollar into the euro and an escalation of the American subprime crisis. The ECB has since flooded markets with short-term money, but despite the rules being bent when the euro was first introduced to aid the German economy, Bundesbank chief Axel Weber and ECB chief economist Jürgen Stark have remained deaf to pleas, which would really help the world in 2008, to bend the rules and allow ECB interest rates to fall. If one is looking at pre-war parallels, one could chart the ebb and flow of money across the Atlantic Ocean. In the late 1920s, because of her strident propaganda, Germany was viewed as poor and less guilty of the war in 1914, but modern historians and economists now believe her to have been primarily responsible for the Great War, and by 1928 more powerful than she was in 1914. European money, including an unspecified amount of German cash, flowed into Wall Street in 1928 and 29. At the end of April of 1929, with a new deal beckoning over the payment of war reparations, Germany put her interest rates up by a full 1% to 7%, prompting interest rate rises in Austria, Poland, and Hungary. From June of 1929, Germany was reported purchasing substantial quantities of gold, an alarmed France following 1 month later. Germany and France's gold purchases were so large that they eventually prompted expectations of a rise in the British bank rate as all the major countries were on the gold standard. Money became tight, and in that environment, financial scandals happened. Clarence Hatry's fraudulent empire collapsed, and soon afterwards, Wall Street crashed. In essence, the Wall Street crash was a political event caused by worries whether German war reparations and debt would ever get repaid, but tight money market conditions also helped the event to take place. In 2007, money in Britain and the U.S. also suddenly became scarce. One hopes that the final parallel with the Great Depression, a stock market crash, is averted. In 1930, Bruning had a vision of what he wished to achieve through deflation, initially to rid Germany of reparations and debt, but also to achieve a measure of rearmament and Germany's return to what he termed a presidential regime. No doubt he visualized the country being led by a former army officer like himself, or maybe a member of the former royal family. But misery embitters people. Hitler became dictator instead. Germany's deflation so far is only a faint shadow of her deflation in the 1930s, but we can surmise that she has aspirations. In 1994, President Clinton prophesied that Germany would be Europe's future leader. In the Middle Ages, she had been leader of the Holy Roman Empire, which encompassed much of Europe. Later, before the First World War, the Pan-German League aimed at creating an empire of all the Germanic peoples under Prussian leadership, which would include all the nations in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, also Switzerland, Holland, and Belgium, and Romania because of her strategic position at the mouth of the Danube. The empire would be bound together first by a customs union, which would prepare the way for the creation of community-wide legal and political institutions. Eventually, a Nationalstaat would come into being impelled by the logic of ethnic solidarity, economic pressure, and, should it prove necessary, military force, unquote. In the First and Second World Wars, Germany became Europe's master by driving tanks into Europe's cities. However, after the Second World War, she turned into a very different country, a bastion of democracy. Later, the European Union evolved, but it was not viewed as Germany's empire either within Germany or in the rest of Europe. Although France and Germany were original members, the EU was formally run by the Council of Ministers, the European Parliament, and by bureaucrats in Brussels rather than by a single state. Democracy is enshrined in the EU, and the voice of each tiny country carries weight. Yet, it is becoming increasingly clear that it has a dominant Franco-German axis, and that Germany is the principal paymaster. So the old adage, he who pays the piper calls the tune, may eventually be appropriate even in the European Union. So far, Germany has behaved with admirable restraint, but she is beginning to flex her muscles. Her huge export surpluses reputedly pay for the deficits of Ireland, Greece, Italy, Spain, and even France, while her own people scrimp and save. At Nice in 2001, her call for greater weighting in the council in the view of her greater population was opposed by France, who insisted that the symbolic parity between the two nations be maintained. Then Germany hoped to secure more power and influence through the constitution, but French and Dutch voters turned it down. However, when Germany took over the presidency of the European Union, her chancellor, Angela Merkel, declared that the time of reflection about a new form of government was over. By March of 2007, the Berlin Declaration was adopted, which declared the intention of all member states to have ratified a new treaty for the government of the enlarged European Union by the 2009 elections. Beyond the treaty, Germany, who stayed firmly in the driving seat during the discussions leading up to the Lisbon Treaty, is now alleged to have ambitions to create a superpower in Europe with military power and control over taxation. One worries that if things do not go her way, she could revert to her old idea of a Germanic empire, which would divide Europe and fragment nations. One also frets about the future economic outlook of the European Union. A German historian recently alleged that in an economic sense, the Second World War amounted to a gigantic struggle between two diametrically opposed views on how to organize the future world market. Closed blocks versus the open door. Lately, talk of community preference, unquote, has mostly been blamed on the French. Yet very few people know that Germany's predatory economic policy beggared the world in the early 1930s and led to military blocks and war. We live in changing times with the rise of India, China, Japan, and the Far East, and the relative decline of the world's greatest superpower, America. Germany has been a pillar of the international community since the war. With the help of the European Union and its most powerful provider of funds, Germany, the countries of the former Soviet Union in Eastern Europe are becoming richer, democratic, and self-confident. Germany has a right to have an important say in the ECB to ensure that her money is well spent. Yet we live in a global economy. Power must be used with care. We must not underestimate Germany's strength because of her citizens' poverty or unemployment. Her deflation and push for the ECB to adopt a high interest rate policy, besides affecting Britain and America, will slow growth for the whole of the European Union and create problems for the weakest states while strengthening her relative position. How Germany will use this position is of fundamental interest, and the parallels up to the present time with the 1930s experience raises cause for concern. So again, the essay from which I've been reading is titled Germany, an Emerging Superpower, Comparisons with the 1930s. It compares Germany's deflationary monetary policy in the wake of the formation of the euro and then raising interest rates in the middle part of this decade with German monetary policy and deflationary monetary policy at that in the early 1930s. And I'm going to read a portion of, reread a portion of that Madrid circular letter. This is from pages 231 and 232 in T.H. Tetten's Germany Plots with the Kremlin, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. And again, this was what the Nazi government in exile circulated from Madrid throughout the Underground Reich and Germany proper. Economic difficulties will one day plunge the United States down from its present dizzy heights. Such a catastrophe can be brought about through crafty manipulations and through artificially engendered crises. Such maneuvers are routine measures which have already been employed in international power struggle and will be used again and again as long as economic rivals fight for power positions and markets in the world. It is quite conceivable that America, weakened by a depression, will one day seek support from a resurrected Germany. Such a prospect would open tremendous possibilities for the future power position of a bloc introducing a new world order, a new order in the world, unquote. Well, again, that certainly looks very much like what's taking place today. And in this context, do not forget my observation that the Bush administration, really most of the Republican Party, has basically been a front for the Underground Reich from the Reagan administration's on. And Bush II's administration was basically just that, in my opinion, a front for the Underground Reich. And it has pretty much destroyed just about all aspects of America. It's done terrible damage to the military. It's ruined America's diplomatic position in the world. This is not to say that American transgressions in the international forum began with the Bush administration. Certainly that is quite obviously not the case. But from institutionalizing torture to completely disregarding the international community of nations, the Bush administration has destroyed America's diplomatic position, destroyed its economy, done what it could to ruin its environment, and generally pretty much defecated in the sheets. And I believe that although many of the people were doing that for selfish reasons or for reasons of ignorance, I think the guiding hand was doing it quite deliberately to undermine America. What I'm going to do is to recapitulate something I've spoken about in the past. Now, in evaluating the assertions made in this broadcast, listeners should reference a number of past programs, and in particular, a couple of programs I did about the coming of the European Monetary Union and the introduction of the euro, those done in the late 1990s and 2000. And also a program that I did, For the Record 99, Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow. Also, I want to review some information, and once again, excerpting some of the books that are available for download for free on the Spitfire website. From the book The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, Secret Germany Behind the Mask by Paul Winkler, published by Scribner in 1943, we read the following, and this is about the ideas of Friedrich Liest, a pan-German theoretician who in the mid-19th century advocated a Central European economic union dominated by Germany in order to unseat Britain as the dominant power in the world and to replace it with Germany. And in that regard also, people should take into account the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and in particular, Paul Manning's discussion of how the various European economies were folded into the German economy after conquest. Other good accounts of that, one comes in the book The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borken. It's also a good discussion of that in the book The Splendid Blonde Beast, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century by Christopher Simpson. But in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, Secret Germany Behind the Mask, published in 1943 by Paul Winkler, there's good discussion of Friedrich Liest's theories, which were then put into effect. Winkler writes, Charles Andler, a French author, summed up certain ideas of Liszt in his work The Origins of Pan-Germanism, published in 1915. Quote, "It is necessary to organize continental Europe against England. Napoleon I, a great strategist, also knew the methods of economic hegemony. His continental system, which met with opposition from countries who might have profited from such an arrangement, should be revived, but this time not as an instrument of Napoleonic domination. The idea of united Europe in a closed trade bloc is no longer shocking if Germany assumes domination over such a bloc and not France. Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, willingly or by force, will enter this customs federation. Austria is assumed to be won over at the outset. Even France, if she gets rid of her notions of military conquest, will not be excluded. The first steps of the Confederation would take to assure unity of thought and action would be to establish a joint representative body as well as to organize a common fleet. But, of course, both the headquarters of the Federation and its parliamentary seat would be in Germany." Note that the European Central Bank is located in Frankfurt. Various first-hand reports have given us a fairly accurate picture of the manner in which Nazi Germany is applying the principle of economic collaboration to the occupied countries, and how, through her agents, she has seized control of all the great industries of France, Belgium, and Holland. We have also seen how she has allowed the whole of her economic policy to be dictated by Hjalmar Schacht. All this indicates clearly that Hitler is merely applying the century-old theories of Liszt in the economic sphere. By the way, for more on the German economic occupation of Europe, a number of books, including Germany's Master Plan, available for download for free on the Spitfire website, will give you an accurate background, in addition to the texts already cited. Now, what we're going to do next is to examine an excerpt from the book Germany Plots with the Kremlins by T.H. Tettens. It was published in 1953. And what we're going to look at is some jottings written by Dorothy Thompson, a journalist with the New York Herald Tribune. Now, Dorothy Thompson is writing in the New York Herald Tribune on May 31st of 1940. And on page 92, T.H. Tettens reprints her comments. And this is what the Germans plan to do in the event of a military victory. Pay close attention. It's not only the realization of Friedrich Liszt's policies, but one, I don't think it requires much of a leap at all to see this as basically what has come to take place: the European Monetary Union, the new world, the new order in the world that the Madrid Circular Letter of 1950 was talking about. Dorothy Thompson, again, writing in the New York Herald Tribune on May 31st, 1940, of what the Germans had in mind in the event of a victory in World War II. "The Germans have a clear plan of what they intend to do in case of victory. I believe that I know the essential details of that plan. I've heard it from a sufficient number of important Germans to credit its authenticity. Germany's plan is to make a customs union of Europe with complete financial and economic control centered in Berlin. This will create at once the largest free trade area and the largest planned economy in the world. In Western Europe alone, there will be an economic unity of 400 million persons. To these will be added the resources of the British, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires. These will be pooled in the name of Europa Germanica." Now, obviously, Germany, by the way, interrupting here, did not conquer Britain, but the rest was pretty much fell into place. "The Germans count upon political power following economic power and not vice versa. Territorial changes do not concern them because there will be no, quote, France, unquote, or, quote, England, unquote, except as language groups. Little immediate concern is felt regarding political organizations. No nation will have the control of its own financial or economic systems or of its customs. The Nazification of all countries will be accomplished by economic pressure. In all countries, contacts have been established long ago with sympathetic businessmen and industrialists. As far as the United States is concerned, the planners of the World Germanica laugh off the idea of any armed invasion. They say that it will be completely unnecessary to take military action against the United States to force it to play ball with this system. Here, as in every other country, they have established relations with numerous industries and commercial organizations to whom they will offer advantages in cooperation with Germany." And by the way, as the Third Reich was preparing to go underground on August 10th of 1944, SS General Dr. Scheid was conveying Martin Bormann's wishes for the economic preservation of Nazi Germany underground and for the Flight Capital Program. And Dr. Scheid went on to comment. Dr. Scheid, and by the way, this is quoted from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It's from the actual documents of that meeting in Strasbourg in Alsace-Lorraine on August 10th of 44. Dr. Scheid also affirmed the ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war. As an example of the kind of support that has been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheid cited the fact that patents for stainless steel belong to the Chemical Foundation New York and the Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of the United States Steel Corporation, Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National Tube, etc., were thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern. He also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line, parenthetically one of the Bush family's businesses run on behalf of Nazi Germany, as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men. These are the German. These are the concerns and the relationships that Germany was counting on in the post-war period. Note the Bush family's prominence there. What we're going to conclude the program with are very quick looks at three different articles. They will be reproduced at greater length in the written discussion to this program. First, we're going to take a look at the chief U.S. economist of Deutsche Bank's basically his advocacy of the TARP program, the setting up basically the taxpayers buying toxic assets as opposed to nationalization of banks. This is the full URL will be available in the description for the program. Joe Lavornia, chief U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank Securities, has written a research note as part of the U.S. Daily Economic Notes titled "Falling Short: The Government Needs to Buy Toxic Assets." Unquote. It says that ultimately the taxpayer will pay one way or another, either through greatly diminished job prospects and or significantly higher taxes down the line. And then goes ahead and advocates the very program which was put into effect by the Obama administration. Another key advocate of this and an apparent architect of this was Mr. Gross, who is Bill Gross, the chairman of PIMCO, a huge bond fund, which is a subsidiary of Allianz, the German insurer, and one of the German core corporations, thereby inevitably part of the Bormann Capital Network. And this is from Talking Points Memo. And it talks about Gross as one of the chief advocates of the plan, and also, of course, his PIMCO company, a subsidiary of Allianz, will be one of the chief beneficiaries of that. And by the way, PIMCO is also poised to profit enormously from picking up some of the properties dumped when the subprime crisis kicked in as well. And we're going to conclude by taking a look at some of the companies that were beneficiaries of U.S. taxpayer money paid out by AIG. In addition to Goldman Sachs at $12.9 billion and Merrill Lynch at $6.8 billion, we have Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wachovia. But other companies that received a lot of money, Société Générale of France, and the French economy was subsumed into the Third Reich's economy, and Deutsche Bank of Germany received a lot, as did UBS of Switzerland, another Bormann bank. This will all be discussed at greater length in the description for the Record 671, but this concludes For the Record 671 Side 2. Update on the Meltdown Part 4, Germany, the Underground Reich, and the Global Economic Crisis. This program has been being recorded on April 26th of the year 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.